Movies and Booze. I'm Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Coming to you today from the South Bar in the K Club. Time for Movies and Booze.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer. This is not just food. This is M&S food.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
We're joined by the glamorous trio of Serena Bellissimo, Brian Lloyd and Michelle Lawler. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Lovely to have you all here. Brian, so Mission Impossible, is this the end of it?
This is the end of it. Tom Cruise, right, in 4 years, he will be able to qualify for the senior citizens bus pass.
Yeah.
In 4 years. 4 years. And he's thrown himself out of an airplane in this. So, like, does Scientology work? That's the question we're all asking each other.
Oh, God. Yeah. But it is it definitely the end?
Oh, no, it's definitely the end. Yeah. No, he physically can't do this anymore. He physically cannot do this anymore. Come on.
He said he's going to do it until he's 100.
Yeah, he'll do films until he's 100, but he's not going to throw himself out of airplanes. And that's literally what we're watching Mission Impossible for is like, you know, can Tom Cruise survive to the end of this film? Like, genuinely. Like,
we know that.
I would imagine, like, in all honesty, I think more of it is the fact that, like, he just can't get insurance anymore. I think that's the real reason why they're stopping. No, seriously.
Okay.
Like,
yeah.
It's that. It is that. Like, the featurettes that, like, Paramount Studios were putting out were insane. Like, I mean, he literally jumps off one biplane onto another, bops a lad in the face, then takes control of the airplane and flies around. And, like, people think that this is all CGI and AI and all that kind of stuff. No, he's doing
he's doing it for real. Yeah.
So,
yeah. You can't help but think he's compensating for something.
Sure. I mean, like, it's the height. Yeah. I don't know.
And the Phoenician scheme, another Wes Anderson.
I mean, you know what you're getting, but I see you're kind of like, are you a skeptic of Wes Anderson? Or?
No, only I would be skeptical to the extent of diminishing returns if he's doing the kind of the same thing.
He's been doing the same thing since the get, like, you know, that kind of way. Like, it's not as if he's changed up the formula that much. But, like, the thing of his films is that they're always so kind of, like, elegantly staged and so kind of, like, fussy. That you can't help but kind of you'll either love it or you hate it. That's the thing. Like, I really think he is like Marmite. You'll either love it and enjoy that kind of fussiness and the sort of, you know, particular nature of it and the kind of deadpan delivery that all the actors do, or you'll hate it and think it's derivative and think it's really annoying and false and blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
And there's no real.
We'll find that out.
Yeah.
Is Jennifer Lopez being sued by the paparazzi? Because usually it's the other way around.
Yeah, no. She's being sued by the paparazzi because she put up, a lot of the stars are starting to do this. So it's not just Jennifer. Other stars have been sued in the past where, you know, there's these gorgeous photos of them that exist out there from award ceremonies and they're putting it up on their Instagram. So the two paparazzos involve the photographer, Edward Blanco, and Backread, who actually are the agency who own this, are saying they want $150,000 from her for using the photo. Because they said it's not just a photo of her. Like, she said something like, oh, you know, GG Weekend Glamour, GG standing for the Golden Globes, because that's what she was there being photographed at. And they're saying it didn't just promote her being there. They're really upset because it promoted who she was wearing, her jewelry, it promoted a whole heap of things, and they didn't get paid for that photo. But then there's this blurry line, right? Yes, they took that photo of her, but the image is her. So, like, where does the copyright stand? And, you know, in previous years, the likes of Dua Lipa, Gigi Hadid, Khloe Kardashian, they've all been sued as well. I was trying to find out.
Successfully.
Well, this is a thing, right? So I went online to see how many people have actually sued successfully. They're still in the courts because they were all coming back with, you say you own this, but you took it of me when I was in a public place. So who does the photo really belong to? So I think this is just great publicity for the paparazzo. Will he get the money? Probably not. I'd say what will happen is it'll just end up in court for a long time going to and fro.
Who has the most money to win?
Yeah, exactly. They'll waste a lot of money doing that.
Exactly. Probably more than the $150,000.
He seems a bit daft. So what are the three wines we're talking about today?
We are going to try Pinot Grigio in its true form, which is pink, which is the wine that you have in front of you. So Whispering Angel, Eat Your Heart Out. And we are going to be trying some Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand. Gorgeous, crisp, fresh, just before the rainstorms come in. And then for when the rainstorms come in, some lovely Malbec. So crunchy, dark reds.
Okay, so tell us about this Pinot in its pure form.
It is actually Pinot Grigio in its pure form.
This is uncut not Pinot Grigio.
This is mashed together Pinot Grigio.
Yeah.
So Pinot Grigio grapes are, unlike white grapes and red grapes, are actually pink-skinned grapes. And so if you want to make a white wine, you get your green grapes. If you were to go to the shop and buy a bunch of white grapes and a bunch of red grapes and cut both of them open, the flesh in the pulp is translucent in both the red and the white grapes. And so how you get the colour is let the skin take time with the juice. And so for Pinot Grigio grapes, this is a pink-skinned grape, so you get a pink-skinned juice. So it's very delicious. And actually, very Italian.
So then how do they make Pinot Grigio when it's white? How do they
do is they crush the grapes, release that flesh and pulp and juice, and then get rid of the skin straight away. Whereas this one, they let the skin spend time on it for a little bit longer to give it a pink hue. And for example, I suppose, like the most famous rosé being Whispering Angel, that's actually made from red grapes. That's not pink grapes. So this is the true form of the truest expression you'd get of Pinot Grigio is this style. And for example, if you were to have champagne, that's actually white grapes and red grapes blended together. But rosé is actually made, the colour comes from the skin, not a blending of red and white grapes together.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And there's if you wanted to go really luxurious on a delicious rosé from Italy, you could have Ramato. Is that a good pronunciation?
What are you saying?
Copper.
Yeah.
Come on, Serena, relax.
No, it was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Yeah. So, you had just drifted off there, hadn't you? Yeah.
I know, I spaced out too.
Oh, you were just enjoying the wine.
Yes, yeah. We were. That's what we were doing.
So,
say it again.
No, Ramato.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Italian for copper? Or is it just an Italian sounding word?
It's an Italian sounding word.
Thanks.
I could have told her that. Anyway, it's Italian sounding.
I will Google that while you talk. Go on.
So Ramato is Italian for copper, or so I'm told. And so if you wanted that classic Italian pink wine, you'd go for that. But it's not made from the Pinot Grigio grapes.
Wait, okay. You think Serena is Italian? She's Greek.
And Italian.
Oh, you told me that.
Greek and Italian.
Italian.
Oh,
okay, Italian, yeah.
And Australian.
And Australian. With Irish kids.
With Irish kids.
So it's just a really, really gorgeous expression of a pink wine and of Pinot Grigio in its truest form. And I think it's delicious and fresh and easy to drink.
And what country does this come from?
So this is Italian.
Oh, right. This is Italian.
So it's Pinot Grigio blush. But if you were to think, like, if you were to go to the shop and buy a Zinfandel blush, so this is dry, but Zinfandel is a red grape and it's like America's most famous pink wine made from the Zinfandel grape, which in itself is really big and rich. But when you get the blush version, there's loads of sugar in it, loads of sugar.
Yeah.
And it's not a great, it's hangover juice, whereas it isn't.
Okay.
Spell it Ramato,
Ramato.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Right,
okay. Oh, I'm definitely saying it wrong if you think it's Romato.
Yeah, that's what we were doing wrong. We got Pomodoro here, and I was like, no, that's not.
That's a tomato.
That was very well pronounced. And that's what it means. Well done.
Well, it means pasta.
No, Pomodoro means tomato.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm totally confused. Right, okay, I don't see many full glasses anyway, so I think the result is in from the jury. We do have to take a break, back in a couple of minutes.
Oh, there we go, look, copper. There, we got it.
Right, so Serena Bryan and Michelle are still with us. Netflix have saved Sesame Street.
Do you know what? I'm still gushing over that story. It's so beautiful. There are some beautiful men out there, so I love that. Anyway, let's go to the man that we all... Trump. He has decided that he's not providing funding anymore for the PBS. Basically, he says that they engage in biased and partisan news coverage, and especially he says this about Sesame Street. Mm-hmm. Like, come on. So it looked like Sesame Street was on its last legs. Do you know when it started broadcasting?
1960-something, wasn't it?
Almost. 1969.
Yeah.
So it has been brought... Like, was it big here? Because it was massive in Australia.
It was huge here.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Ernie and Bert and Elmo were about to go bye-bye.
Big Bird.
You know, Snuffleupagus has gone. Yeah.
They got rid of him.
Yeah, they got rid of him because people didn't like the imaginary character thing. But Netflix have come in. And they've said, we're going to save this. So what I love about what they're doing, though, is because not everybody can afford Netflix. So they're going to have it up on Netflix, but they're also allowing PBS to broadcast the episode.
Okay,
so the date goes live on Netflix, it'll be live on PBS. So no one loses out. I think it's great.
Okay. Yeah. Except for everyone outside the United States who have to pay for Netflix. But...
No,
you can't win them all.
No, all right. No. It's on PBS. That's a station over there. That their PBS is an actual channel. Over
I know, I said outside the
outside. Edge.
Oh.
But in fair, but oh. you can access, but hold on, you can access, you are able to access PBS if you have a computer.
Are you?
Yeah, you can watch PBS.
Legit?
Yeah, legit. It's all, like, it's free to air and all the rest.
Anyway, Elmo, Ernie, Bert, they're not going anywhere. They're sticking around, which is great news.
Okay, that's good to know. And there's going to be, they've commissioned season 5 of The Young Offenders.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. I thought it was all over with season 4. And look, I love The Young Offenders. It started off as a movie. And then it's always great to see great Irish success stories. BBC took this on board. We had 4 seasons. It pains me to say this, I didn't love season 4 as much, only because it wasn't as much about the boys. Jock was stuck in prison and the other one was in Cork or vice versa.
I think it was actually because like the cast of it were off doing other work other stuff, as a result.
Which is fantastic, because it means they're all doing well. But everybody's coming back for season 5 and it'll be set in Cork again. And great news, if you want to be involved in the show, they're still casting for some places. So you can send your tape into corkcasting.com. So go to corkcasting.com and information's on there of how you could possibly become a part of the show.
Okay, so actual speaking parts?
Yeah, I think so.
Standing around in the background.
I think a bit of everything. So looking to, you're playing.
Yeah, who wouldn't want to do that? Excuse me, I was once in the background of Glen Rowe.
You were not.
I was.
What were you doing?
It was a raffle. In RTE, they would raffle things like you could be an extra on Glen Rowe. And so we were like, there was a bar scene.
Yeah.
And myself and another woman who worked on RTE, like, we won this thing where we could be in the background in Glen Rowe. So we decided, like, you know, you're supposed to just kind of talk and chat and, you know, when Biddy and Miley are getting off with each other or something in the foreground. So we decided to start scratching ourselves. Just to imply there was some sort of, you know, scabies outbreak in the bar.
Some sort of flesh-eating disease has ravaged all of Glen Rowe and it started here.
And they cut us out.
Oh, so you didn't even make it?
No. Well, you could barely, you could see as soon as one of us started moving our hands. Close-ups.
Sounds like a wooden spoon prize in the raffle.
Like the crap one, basically.
Like the crap one, yeah.
Like the crap one. Yeah, I suppose it was probably. Yeah.
Well,
it
lost the raffle. Let's say,
it didn't actually cost them anything as a prize.
He was in the clinic.
What?
I was in the clinic. Remember the clinic?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was a background extra in the clinic for like a couple of episodes. Literally got up and walked around. That was it. They were filming it in the Bailey. And I was living in Clane at the time, so I like, had to basically get the bus up at like 7 o'clock in the morning. Like there, the entire day, did nothing. And then literally, like, was like, okay, so we just want you to get up out of here, just walk over there and sit back down. And I was like, that's it? Like, I've spent like 8 hours to literally get up and walk around.
That's
I got paid, though. So
yeah, that's what extras do.
That's it. It's like extra work is just like donkey work. Like, there is nothing to it. You're literally just sitting around all day.
I'd like to try that.
You can. Well, you can go to corkcasting.com.
Fill your boots.
Yeah. So, our second wine, Michelle.
Our second wine is Classic Malibu Sauvignon Blanc from Marks & Spencer's. So, this is the classic New Zealand-style Sauvignon Blanc. And if you're thinking, why would I have a French Sauvignon Blanc over a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, and how can I taste the difference between the two? It's really easy to kind of think about it in terms of where on the map, on the global map, are you and what grows there. So if you think of Loire, the home of French Sauvignon Blanc, that's like the Donegal of France, that northwestern tip. And what you can grow there is like white orchard fruit. So in a French Sauvignon, you're going to be tasting those apples and pears. But if you think of New Zealand, where it's much warmer, what fruits are going to be growing there? Well, kiwis, anyway.
Yeah.
The obvious one. But you're going to get that more, because there's more sunshine there, those more ripe tropical fruit aromas. And that's exactly what you taste in that. And so if you're in the shop and you're thinking, okay, which type of Sauvignon do I fancy tonight? Do I want, like, you know, pineapples, mangoes and kiwis? Sounds like a kind of lilt job. But those tropical fruit flavours, New Zealand is perfect for that. Do I want something a little bit more subtle, those pears and apples? Then you would go towards France. And New Zealand has, or Marlborough, where this one is from, has 2,400 sunshine hours, which is more than most parts of France. So it is like a hot, like a warm, ripe, sunny region. But what makes the New Zealand Sauvignon so special is that although New Zealand is in the southern hemisphere, it's actually considered cool climate. So it's got beautiful acidity. And if you have a taste of it, you can tell, like, it's really juicy. It really makes your chops go. It makes your mouth water. So it's like a really beautiful style. And has anyone, have you been to New Zealand? Have you been to
Marlborough?
Yeah,
I was in New Zealand.
Did you go to the wine regions?
No.
And have a gander around?
With Lord of the Rings, that's all I was there.
Oh, amazing.
That and my wife was there at the time, so that's why
I was So I did in 2008, I did Harvest in New Zealand, and there was so much Sauvignon Blanc that year that they called it the Savalanche, because there was grapes coming from every direction. But we stayed in this really cool place called Waihopi Valley. Have you ever heard of Spy Valley? So when you drive through, if anyone's ever tasted a Spy Valley wine or been to Marlborough, when we were going to, and the winery I was working for, like, put us up. So you drive around this bend and then you see what look like these two giant golf balls, except they had red lights in the top flashing. So it looked like weird boobies nearly.
Mm.
It was a spy, and it was actually the New Zealand spy area. And what it was, it's mental. It's now decommissioned. But in 2008, we were going to work every morning and there was like a Greenpeace protest going by back and forth, went on for maybe a week and a half. And one morning we were going to work and one of them had slashed. And so it was covered in what looked like white lycra. I'm sure it wasn't lycra. And there was a 58-foot satellite under the lycra, and it was listening to everything in the Asia Pacific region. It's since been decommissioned, and I think the government took 1.2 million over the three lads from Greenpeace to recoup the lycra.
But, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good story. I wonder where the Irish listening station is.
Sure. Yeah. A lot more dodgy things going
secret.
On there.
No yeah, one knows yeah. where it is.
But it's funny, they actually embrace it. I literally come around the corner and these, like, if you imagine the satellite's 58 foot, but it was globe shaped. But it was funny because you'd always see the lights flashing. You knew you were nearly home when you saw the nipples going. You
know? Right. We do have to take a break. Back with more Movies and Booze after this. We'll move on to our first movie of the day. It is Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Here's a clip.
The CIA Black Vault break-in.
Am I reading this correctly? The Kremlin bombing?
In fairness, the bomb was actually meant to kill him.
He gassed a security briefing.
That was just 2 months ago.
This explains the handcuffs. It's still not clear why he's here.
If we want to bring the world back from the brink, we have to deal with him.
Should he choose to accept?
Smart people on every side are close to panicking.
What exactly is your plan?
Okay. In that last bit, he's got into some sort of box and thing.
Yeah, he basically... That's right. So in the last... the film previous to this was called Dead Reckoning. And essentially that was about this artificial intelligence called The Entity that has basically taken over all the intelligence networks in the world.
Okay.
And is slowly working its way towards the nuclear weapons of all those countries that you saw mentioned there. So that's Russia, China, Israel, France, Iran, America, and the US. And now Ethan Hunt, Tom Cruise, is a race against time to basically try to stop the entity from taking over the nuclear arsenals of all this country. The reality of it is that they are not making any more Tom Cruises. There is no one coming after him that can... you know, do the kind of stunts that he does that can open a film on the strength of his name and his name alone. And this really is basically him trying to send off Mission Impossible and the idea of, you know, practical effects and the idea of sort of tactile, textured action films. Because the reality of it is, first of all, it's too dangerous. Second of all, it's too expensive because of the insurance. And third of all is that audiences... as much as they want this kind of stuff, the reality is it just cannot be done because the studio systems, as we know, are basically breaking down little by little. And this is really a kind of a send-off to it. So when you're watching this, I mean, you kind of have to watch it with the idea that it's a metaphor for Hollywood itself basically collapsing in on itself, and that artificial intelligence, CGI, all the rest of it is basically going to swallow it all unless one man, Tom Cruise, takes them all back from the brink. You could watch it and infer that, you know, Tom Cruise has a savior complex, that it's, you know, just him is going to save the world. And they really do lean into this. Like, you're watching this and it's like, okay, calm down. I get it. Like, I mean, he's great. I am 100% on board with the Cruiser. I remember seeing the first one when I was 10 years old in Dara Cinema in Nice. I'm locked in. I believe he can do it. I mean, look what he did with Top Gun Maverick. I mean, this was right after COVID. Cinemas were on their knees. Top Gun Maverick comes out and it makes $1 billion worldwide, brings cinemas back from the brink. So for him to have this kind of savior complex, I'm not saying it's justified. I'm not saying it's earned. But, like, I mean, Jesus, if I was him, I'd be thinking, okay, maybe I can do this.
But he's the world's last movie star.
That's really it. I mean, that's really it. He is the last movie star. Like, you even look at, like, Brad Pitt, and he's doing F1, the movie. It's all about the fact that it's Formula One. It's not necessarily that it's Brad Pitt people are going to see, you know? Mm. And, like, again, you know, I keep saying this, like, we live in a world of excess entertainment. There has never been more avenues of entertainment than there has ever been. There are new films every week. There are new TikToks every week. There are YouTube channels. There is Netflix. There is Disney Plus. There's Amazon Prime. There's MGM Plus. There's Apple TV. There's all sorts of entertainment. There's radio. There's podcasts. There's everything. People are being pulled in every single direction. We no longer have a monoculture anymore. And Tom Cruise is in the same way that, like, you know, Prince or Madonna or George Michael, they are the last of the sort of the anchor points in monoculture. And this is him basically the farewell tour, if you know what I mean. And he deserves it.
Yeah, but I mean,
it's three hours long, right?
I know, it's 3 hours long and loads of people get shot. I mean, are you layering a bit too much metaphor on this?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sitting around, you know, stroking his chin, thinking, how can I deploy the...
Yeah, I mean,
display the death of Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, what I would say about it is that when it's good, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, the last 40 minutes of this are some of the best action cinema I've seen in the last 10 years. Unfortunately, the first 90 minutes of it is basically a montage of the last six films. And it, like, ropes in all these characters that were tangentially mentioned. And it's like, hey, we found this guy. We're bringing him back in. Remember him? That was 30 years ago. Here he is now. And it's like, I don't care. Like, I mean, just get to the... Jump off a building. Do something. Like, you know what I mean? I don't need you all standing around, you know, eulogizing Tom Cruise's character and, like, you know, he did this and this was 2 months ago and who is this guy? You know, like, I get it. You know, like, tell the story walking. Like, you know.
Okay. Oh, so they're trying to kind of make, kind of have some sort of narrative arc between the first movie.
Correct. Yeah. That's it. And again, it is so belabored because, you know, the best film in this entire series, in my opinion, is Mission Impossible Fallout. And that was literally, a nuclear weapon has been stolen and Ethan Hunt has to go after it. It is simple, direct, and to the point. And it's the best one because it focuses in on the action. It makes it realistic. It makes it kind of punchy. The editing is fantastic. You do, anything that's outside of anything that doesn't serve the story, cut away straight away. There isn't an ounce of fat on it. This, on the other hand, it's nearly 3 hours long. You could easily cut the first 90 minutes out of it and you'd have a much, much better film. But unfortunately, because this is the last film, it's trying to eulogize it. It's trying to kind of, you know, give it a sense of grandiosity. It's trying to, you know, send it off with the kind of the pomp and circumstance that it deserves. And I feel that's doing it a disservice because ultimately this is a film that, for all the convolutedness of it and all like the spy and the ripping off the stuff, it's a very... It's a very straightforward story. Like, you know, anyway, man with a mission trying to do his best and flinging himself out of airplanes and jumping motorcycles over the Champs-Élysées and all the rest of it. Like, it's very much just about how can we put Tom Cruise in the most dangerous situation possible with very, very little safety standards and hope for the best and just catch it all on brilliant cameras. Like, that's it. That's the Mission Impossible ethos.
Okay, so a kind of a disappointing end to the season to that run then.
I mean, again, this is the thing. It's so frustrating when you're watching it, when it's really cooking, it's brilliant. When it's bad, it's terrible. And I know that kind of sounds like a bit of a cop-out, but, like, it's, you know, for 3 hours, you're like, just come on. Just get on with it. Like, get on with it. Like,
what's his next film going to be?
He's big into musicals. Apparently, he really wants to do a musical, which, funny enough, I could see because, like, the whole thing about Tom Cruise is that he's a big believer in, like, silent cinema, and he kind of compares himself, and rightfully so, I would argue, to the likes of Howard Lloyd, to the likes of, you know, Buster Keaton and all the rest of it. These kind of, like, song and dance men, as it were. And, you know, throughout his career, the one thing you could never say to Tom Cruise is he never half-arses anything.
No.
Every film he's in, he is given 110%. Everyone else might be phoning it in. He is not. He will throw himself into it. And to see him doing like some sort of like song and dance kind of musical, I think would be brilliant. Like, I think
and he can dance.
And he can dance. Yeah. And I'm sure he could sing as well if he put his mind to it. Like, so yeah, him doing some sort of like song and dance music. And even like in Tropic Thunder, like he turns up in that for like 5-10 minutes and he's the funniest thing in
it. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think he'll get an Oscar for this?
No, because
in the stunt performer category, like this might be the first time he actually gets an Oscar.
Well, no, that's not coming in, I think, until 2028, I want to say.
Did that not come in last year?
No, they announced it this year.
Yeah, and I don't think it's for a stunt performer, it's the people who planned
it. It's all like the stunts.
Oh,
like,
I thought he'd finally get an Oscar.
He'll get the lifetime achievement when like they'll roll him out when he's 95 and they'll give him one.
Oh, he'll probably pogo out when he's 95.
Yeah, exactly.
In a human pyramid. All right. Okay, well, all right, so nah.
Do you know what? It's worth the if you love action movies, give it a go by all means. But just be prepared for the fact that there's 90 minutes of faff.
But say for instance, say you went to this movie and then you sat down and then you bought some bad popcorn.
Right.
And then the popcorn had an instant effect on your digestive system. You have to run to the toilet. And you spent 90 agonizing minutes in the toilet.
Sure.
And then you were okay again. You walked back in. Would you have missed anything?
No.
No. There you go then. Right.
Truth be told. But I mean, I would rather be sitting there taking 90 minutes than 90 minutes losing 10 stone.
I know. I was a more dramatic example.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So. All right. You could do a bit of ironing and then.
Well, this is it. Like, you know, you can catch up on your correspondence. You know what I mean? You can call your mate. I don't know. You can do something.
Yeah. Okay. So, reboot news.
Yeah.
Seventh Heaven and Scrubs.
Yeah, there's too much reboot news. Like, you know, I'm excited that Sesame Street is saved, but do we need to bring other things back from extinction? Seventh Heaven, that was, remember the really goody-goody show that Jessica Biel.
Jessica Biel.
That's why her name
is. Jennifer Beals was Flashdance.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Jessica Biel was in Seventh Heaven, and now they're saying they're going to bring it back. None of the cast are coming back. She's going to come back as an executive producer. It still hasn't got the green light, but what they're saying is that it's going to be a diverse family and that none of the cast coming back, but we don't know. So this is a non-story that everyone got excited about during the week because we have no details, we have no confirmation, we just have hope. So
people
if you
care
love...
enough about Seventh Heaven. Like...
Well, do you know there's a podcast? There's a Seventh Heaven... You will?
Maybe you don't need hope. It sounds like you could pass on it.
Yeah. But Seventh Heaven has a podcast. If you are a fan, the two younger kids are doing a rewatch podcast and Jessica sometimes turns up on it. So if you're really missing Seventh Heaven, maybe do that. But Scrubs, there's also talks about that coming back. That was brilliant because it was brilliant at the time. Do we need it? Zach Braff has said, look, I think there's a possibility of it happening. It looks like they've locked him in.
Oh.
So getting him, now they need to go back and get all the cast. But where I'm really worried about this, the reason why this was so good was because of the cast, but it was also because of the guy behind it, Bill Lawrence, who has also done Ted Lasso. He's doing Shrinking. But because he's got so much on his plate, he's not going to come back and showrun this. So I don't know if this will be as good. If you're really missing it, this also has a rewatch podcast with Zach
Braff and Donald Faison. Yeah.
So go listen to that if you like. Again, it's a bit of a non-story in that we don't have too much information about it, but it looks like Zach Braff really wants to make this happen.
Okay, so something might or might not be happening.
Exactly.
Yes, we're definitely going to talk about the red wine.
Red wine is definitely happening. Okay, so the red wine that we have is M&S Rastra's Malbec. So this is from Argentina, and 20 years ago, no one was drinking Malbec. Everyone was drinking Rioja. And then Malbec arrived on the scene, and it became so popular, and largely for two reasons. One, it's really easy to pronounce, or really hard to mispronounce. So you could order a Malbec very easily, and none of your friends or whoever you're with would go, I don't think that's how you say it. And the other reason...
I thought it was going to be like, because you're half... Can I get
I think it's multiple Giano kind of gives people the old heebie-jeebies, I'll take the Malbec. So the other reason is that it's really, really consistent. And if you think about Chardonnay, for example, the white grape, you don't know what you're going to get. Oaked, not oaked, you know, fresh and fruity, really full on. But with Malbec, it was one of those grapes that it just did exactly what it said on the tin for a couple of reasons.
But we should point out it doesn't come in a tin.
Some wines do come in tins now, worryingly.
And currants.
Seriously.
Oh, yeah.
And currants as well.
Oh, cartons in Australia.
Cartons are easy. Tins, you definitely grimace at. Anyway, let's move on.
Yeah.
So Malbec, what makes it, I suppose, so consistent and so consistently delicious is that in the Andes, it's really high in the mountains. And if you think about, if you were to go walking in the mountains yourselves, it's cold in the morning, it's warm in the afternoon, it's cold in the evening again. And so it's this thing called the diurnal temperature changes. And if you've got it really hot and then cold, it gives the grapes a chance to have a break and to not over-ripen, not kind of get cooked or jammy. So they have this really long ripening season. And what you get is like the structure of a French wine with the fruit juiciness of something from Australia in a consistent way. So nearly every time you go to buy a Malbec, they'll very, very, very little. They'll always taste in that lovely kind of dark, plummy fruit flavours. But Malbec, in fact, is actually a French grape, widely planted all across Bordeaux. And there was a frost in, and across France. And there was a big frost in 1956, wiped out Malbec, because it's quite a fickle grape to grow in France. And they just never bothered again, really, with it.
Huh.
And so what happened? But Argentina in the interim time had created quite a global icon. You know, it's their kind of flagship grape. But the French have become a little bit jealous, I would say, of the Malbec grape. So you've now got this huge wave of French producers producing Malbec, not in the French style, which would be, I suppose, more rustic and farmyardy and big and tanniny, but in the Argentinian style. So it's kind of really counterintuitive. But the region, if you wanted to go and try a French Malbec, the region is called Cahors. And they do produce a lot of wines in this style. So fun and fruity. But again, totally opposite to what you, when you're going to order like an Argentinian Malbec, Cahors has a silent S at the end of it. All of a sudden, it's not so easy to say, and you know, you might know what you're going to get anymore. But interestingly, Malbec had over 1,000 indigenous names in France. And seemingly, there was some farmer called Mr. Malbec, no joke, was propagating it, apparently, and that's why we're all drinking what is now called Malbec today.
Wow, Mr. Malbec.
Mr. Malbec, what a great name.
Good man, Mr. Malbec. Kieran Culkin's going to be in The Hunger Games.
Yeah, now I wasn't...
weird.
Yeah, well, not really. I think he's going to be perfect for this, I have to say, if you can't tell already. I don't love a reboot, like, let's go back to the start, whatever. But as soon as his name was mentioned, this is The Hunger Games, Sunrise on the Reaping. So this is, I think it's about 25 years before what we've seen. So they go back, and the character he's playing is Stanley Tucci's character.
Caesar Flickerman.
He's going to be brilliant. Kieran Culkin is on, his trajectory has been amazing. You know, he's won Emmys for Succession. He's won his Oscar for A Real Pain. He's starring in a Broadway play at the moment. Who knows if he'll be nominated for Tonys for that. He's two away
from
an Eagle.
Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross, and he's brilliant, isn't he? He's Ricky Roma.
So he's only two things away from an EGOT, and I think him being cast makes me want to go see this reincarnation.
Ray Fiennes is in it as well. Ray Fiennes is playing the baddie in it as
Yeah,
well.
And so
it's a good cast.
It's a great cast. Elle Fanning is playing Elizabeth Banks's character, Effie. So look, I think this could work, but I think the fact that they've gotten him is going to be the cherry on top.
Okay. But Kieran Culkin is... And I don't mean this as a criticism. It's kind of, he plays Kieran Culkin.
Exactly. So that's why I think he's going to be brilliant in this.
But surely, I've said this before, you don't give Jeff Goldblum guff for playing Jeff Goldblum.
No, like, but that's what you get.
You're
kind of thinking about, does a Kieran Culkin type fit in The Hunger Games? Does a Jeff Goldblum type fit in The Hunger Games?
He does, because the character that Stanley Tucci's playing is basically like this TV presenter on crack cocaine, like, and he's got like these big huge like hairdos and all the rest of it. So like, imagining Kieran Culkin playing that kind of role, he could do it very, very easily, I would think.
Okay, fair enough.
It's not going to be much of a stretch to imagine him in that world. Now do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, we'll move on to our second movie. It is The Phoenician Scheme. Here's a clip.
We're starting our descent. Prepare your documents before we deplane so you never delay my schedule. Passports.
She's brilliant. Mm.
Where's yours?
I don't have a passport. Normal people want the basic human rights that accompany citizenship in any sovereign nation. I don't. My legal residence is a shack in Portugal. My official domicile is a hut on the Black Sea. My certificated abode is a lodge perched on the edge of a cliff overlooking the sub-Saharan rainforest, accessible only by goat path. I don't live anywhere. I'm not a citizen at all. I don't need my human rights.
Ooh, great.
So, the character that Benicio del Toro is playing there is based on kind of like, you know, Aristotle Onassis or J.P. Getty. He's this sort of like buccaneer businessman of the 50s. And he has taken it upon himself to come up with this big, huge, massive civil engineering scheme in a fictional Middle Eastern country called Phoenicia. And as part of the financing of this project, he's enlisted, you know, these two American tycoons. One of them is played by Tom Hanks, the other is played by Bryan Cranston. He's roped in the monarchy of that country as well. The prince is played by Riz Ahmed. He's roped in his second cousin, that's played by Scarlett Johansson. And it's basically the entire film, him is going to his business partners and basically trying to convince them that they're going to have to chip in more money in order to meet the gap, because the CIA and sort of American business interests have got it into their head that Benicio del Toro's character has been swindling them and has been cornering the market. All while this is happening, he decides to reconnect with his daughter, you saw there played by Mia Threapleton, who's Kate Winslet's daughter, by the way, and she's brilliant in it. She was a nun in training, and he's taken her out of the nunnery and is basically trying to school her in business while she is trying to get him to reconnect with his humanity. I would say, you know, it has more kind of in line with something like Grand Budapest Hotel, which is that this very kind of like caper-esque kind of thing. And those, I think, are the best Wes Anderson films where, you know, it's man on a mission. It's very much kind of like a rah, rah, rah. We've got to keep going. We've got to keep going. And that kind of like deadpan patter that he's able to write so well, the actors in it respond to it so, so well because they're used to it. You know, that sort of way. He always works with the same actors again and again and again because they get the vibe. They get what they're going for. The new addition to this, however, is Michael Cera, who you saw there, and he is fantastic in this. He plays this botanics professor called Bjorn, and he has this ridiculous Norwegian accent the whole way through. It's so, so funny. All of this is to say, really, that it's Wes Anderson at his most Wes Anderson-y, and that is, you know, I fully admit it's an acquired taste, because like some people will think, oh God, he's just doing the same thing over and over again. And it's like, oh, they're all kind of funny and quirky and it's all really fussy and everything's symmetrical. Wow, what a shock. But people will go to the cinema to see that because there's an element of familiarity and comfort in it. You know, that kind of way, you know what you're getting. And the story is so kind of richly written and the characters are so sort of identifiable, even if it's built around artifice. Like, you look at like Royal Tenenbaums as an example, right? And what Gene Hackman did in that film. If you've had any kind of a lovable rogue as a parent, you will look at Royal Tenenbaums and know exactly who that is. You will identify with it straight away. And it's the same in this as well. Benicio del Toro's character, he's this kind of like, he has this great line and it goes, if anything gets in your way, flatten it.
Yeah.
Which is so kind of like, you know, brilliant line. And there's some great one-liners in this as well. And again, you know these kind of larger-than-life characters that, you know, you are drawn to, even though you know they're a shit. You know they're a terrible person, but you're still kind of drawn to them because they don't really make them like that anymore, you know that kind of way? So,
Yeah, okay.
It's enjoyable. I really enjoyed this. I really, like, fiendish and entertaining and, yeah, I loved it.
But is it one of his better ones?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think it's a return to form. I think Asteroid City was a little bit of a dip. I think, you know, COVID kind of really played havoc with his style and he had to kind of graft it into that. But this, it's back on form. It's like big, elaborate set pieces. It's almost kind of like an action movie in a way. I would say this is as close as he's ever going to get to an action movie. Like, except you have like Richard Ayoade playing a communist terrorist blowing stuff up with a machine gun. Like, it's that kind of, it's that, but not. It's not Mission Impossible, obviously.
It's what Mission Impossible should have been.
Yes, exactly. 100%. We need more communists.
Yeah. That's our lot for today. Thanks to Brian and Serena and Michelle. Thanks to everybody here at the K Club as well for looking after us. Kieran's up next on News Talk. We are giving away a prize for a two-night stay here at the K Club. That goes to Tony Fitzsimons in Donnycarney in Dublin. In a wild fit of optimism, he thinks the Children's Hospital will open before the end of this century. Good luck with that. Our production team today, Leah Donnelly, Niamh Hamill, Simon Tierney, Michael Quilligan, Aidan McKelvey, David Slevin, Belden Griffin and William Murphy. We'll talk to you on Monday. Have a lovely weekend.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.